place on calendar today is Wynn Las Vegas versus Baldonado, case number 60358. Are council ready to proceed? Please do. Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 7 minutes, please.
Very well.
Chief Justice Pittman, may it please the court, Eugene Scalia, representing appellants. As a key matter of statutory interpretation, the Wynn tip policy at issue in this case does not violate the Labor Code prohibition on employers, quote, taking, quote, employee tips. Also, as a clear matter of statutory interpretation, the Wynn policy falls within the safe harbor that exists for tip pooling practices. Moreover, the Wynn policy is entirely consistent with this court's decisions in Alford and Baldonado and with other case law. For these reasons alone, the decision below should be reversed. The decision of the Labor Commissioner should be affirmed. But moreover, the decision of the Labor Commissioner is due substantial deference. The Labor Commissioner in this case conducted 10 days of hearings, heard from 29 witnesses, and on the basis of that, the basis of those facts, and after a thoughtful 18-page opinion, concluded that Wynn had not violated the statute based on numerous factual findings that were not under challenge here. Finally, the district court's decision that class certification was appropriate here is plainly erroneous and should also be reversed. I thought it would be helpful to begin with certain factual findings that were made by the Labor Commissioner, indeed facts that are undisputed before the panel now, which under the understanding that we believe makes this actually a very straightforward and simple case result. So if I could start there and then turn to the applicable legal standards. First fact that's not in dispute is that the casino service team leads and the box persons at issue are employees. That was a stipulation by the parties, a stipulation number 7. They are employees. They are not the employer. Second fact, not in dispute. Those employees are tipped. The dealers effectively can see that on page 14 of their brief. The Labor Commissioner made that finding based on testimony and substantial evidence. It's not under challenge here. So they're employees, they're tipped employees. Third fact that's not in dispute and stipulated, stipulation 28, again a finding by the Labor Commissioner as well. Wynn does not take those tips. It does not itself take customer money, use the money, put the money in its coffers. It does not itself use that money. That's also a stipulation. And then fourth, finally, although not essential to the case, the Labor Commissioner concluded as well that tips that are given to individual employees are not necessarily intended for that particular employee. The Labor Commissioner said that he had heard, quote, considerable testimony, quote, on the reasons for tipping, and it simply wasn't reasonable to conclude that it was for that particular employee rather than an appreciation for their experience at the casino as a whole, or simply to share the rewards of a good night at the tables.
Could you return to what you describe as an undisputed fact, which is that the Wynn does not use the tip income in any way? What is the actual stipulated fact on that?
The actual stipulation, I'll read it to you, is that dealers, casino service team leads, and boxmen may receive a share of the tips. So it is only they who receive and get the tips. Now, there is a disputed ultimate legal question of whether Wynn somehow is taken, but as to who actually gets the tips, there's no evidence that those tips go in the Wynn's pocket. They go only into the pockets of those particular people.
Well, but is there a stipulation, and maybe I misheard you, that Wynn does not use those tips in any way?
Not specifically use, and if I said that, I misspoke.
Okay.
But it doesn't actually receive them, Your Honor.
I may have misheard you.
Yeah, I may have misspoken on that. So again, all of these facts are not subject to dispute, that these are employees, that they are tipped employees, that Wynn does not receive the money into its coffers, and again, that the tips are not necessarily for the particular employee. We believe that given those facts, there's really nothing to dispute in this case under any applicable legal standard, but to turn now to the legal standard and some of the questions the court has put to the parties in the case. First, the plain meaning Section 608-160. That statutory provision for relevant purposes does two things. First, it prohibits taking of tips. And to understand that term, I think it's helpful to recall the history of the provision, because starting in 1939 until the amendment in 1971 that's really an issue here, employers could take tips. They just had to put a sign up telling customers that tips given to employees will be taken, that is, received by management. So they were taken in the obvious literal sense of the word that's an issue in this case. They were the company's tips. What happened in 1971 is there was a 180-degree change. The tips couldn't be taken by the employer. They weren't the employer's tips anymore. Rather, they had to be among the employees. So when seeking to ascertain what's meant by taking, simply the historical practice itself, under the old statute, shows what taking means. The second relevant provision, of course, is the tip pooling provision itself. And what that does is it expressly validates tip pooling practices and establishes a safe harbor whereby any pooling practice where tips are shared among employees, don't go in the employer's pocket, those are meant to be put in a safe harbor, carved out from any taking analysis and set aside. The reason that was done, because you did have that substantial change in Nevada law whereby taking is now prohibited, but there was concern, obviously, to protect tip pooling practices that existed at the time. That's how those provisions function. And to address one of the questions that this court posed for argument today, which is, who makes the decision here about pooling practices? I would say first, the legislature. Very clearly what the legislature intended to do was, explicitly actually, establish a rule of construction whereby the take provision shall not be construed to invade tip pooling practices. Those are meant to be set off and protected. That was a legislative decision, and then there was a decision, obviously a corollary to that, that private practice, that private entities would make decisions regarding tip pooling themselves, not the courts. There are a number of amicus briefs in this case. I appreciate that they don't always get read immediately before argument. I wanted to emphasize a statement on the third page of the amicus brief submitted by the colony workers, because I think it's really a pretty remarkable statement. It lines up very closely with what the labor commissioner said as well. So what the colony workers said, they said if the courts get into it, that is, arbitrary tip pooling practices, they will never get out, and this will become big business for them. The union knows this probably better than anyone else. Dealing with questions of tip distribution is a constant and significant part of its work. Tipped employees are intelligent and creative in their arguments about how tips should be divided. It is usually the case that there are multiple credible, well-argued points of view that are incompatible. The Labor Commissioner, page 12, also expresses virtually dismay at the prospect of being drawn into making decisions about these tip pools. So just to dwell on that for a moment, what the plaintiffs are urging, and I'll come into some more detail in a moment, is a practice of judicial review of who's in the pool, how closely related their job functions are, the relative contributions different people make to the experience, including the service that's given, presumably how much a share each participant should get in the tip pool, on down the line. This would be an extremely difficult thing for the courts to police. Here you have the colony workers. You know, honestly, tip pooling is a practice that is broad throughout industry. This isn't just a case about the Wynn Casino. It isn't just a case about gaming. It's as much or more about restaurant practices, which is why the Nevada Resort Association and the Restaurant Association both also filed an amicus brief saying this would be extremely disruptive of our practices as well, to have courts weighed in to try to make these decisions, which the colony workers are saying, we deal with this all the time, it's very hard, it would be big business for the court, respectfully. I don't think that's the kind of big business this court would want to spend its time performing.
Well, the court system gets drawn into a lot of conflicts that are precipitated by uncertainties in legislation. This may be another example of that, counsel. Obviously, just from the competing briefs, it's clear that people disagree about how this statute should be applied. I'm concerned about the plain language of the statute, which seems to say that the decision about how to divide tips is left to employees. There's no mention of the employer. What do you say about that?
Respectfully, I don't believe that's how the statutory language reads. The phrase I believe you're referring to is that nothing in this section shall be construed to prevent such employees from entering into an agreement, to divide such tips or gratuities among themselves. The agreement is not one that's described as among themselves. It's the sharing that's among themselves. As long as the sharing is among themselves, it's not determinative who the agreement is among. And if this court were to hold that only consensual, entirely voluntary employee tip pooling is permitted, it would fill out decades and generations of practice and be immensely disruptive of industry, as both the culinary workers and the Restaurant and Resort Association have explained, because mandatory tip pooling was approved in the Alfred decision 30 years ago, and of course had been approved as well as Mellon, which I'll come to in a moment, and I appreciate as a federal court decision. But nonetheless, Mellon said, this is how things have been done for a long time. So respectfully, I don't think the statutory language commands that construction at all. I think it should be read instead that any agreement among people who might be concerned with the industry. And that's consistent as well with past practice and any of the deference to the Labor Commissioner.
I'd be concerned about how an election like this would be held. Like, how would you do this with the employees? So who would vote, who would not vote, who would supervise the election? I'm worried about screwing up the actual right of these employees, but I also worry about management having to supervise an election like this.
Understood. What do you do if an employee who voted one way changes their mind the next day? What do you do when new employees join the group? There are just a limitless number of problems that could arise, and without the employer being able to step in and make decisions ultimately and say, you have a choice. You can take this approach and agree with me on this approach, or you can seek work elsewhere. Without the ability of the employer to do that, is recognized since then, and certainly since Alfred, it would be immensely disruptive in industry, and I think you have numerous amicus briefs.
Have there been any legislative changes to subparagraph 2 since it was construed first by Judge Thompson in Mullen, and then in Alfred, and by Senator Bryan, then A.G. Bryan, in terms of the among themselves modifying the sharing, not the agreement, if you follow my question?
Many have been enacted, Chief Justice Pickering, so they've been put before recently different times on a handful of occasions. They've not gone through.
So that language has not changed?
That's correct.
The judicial gloss then has stood
that's
for
correct.
30 or 35 years?
It's received the acceptance of the legislature. And the other thing that's remarkable is that we're here before the court on this issue. These parties have been before the court before only that. But this is not a heavily litigated provision. There should be some comfort in that as well. There can be no such comfort if the court were to take the approach advocated by plaintiffs. Again, I bring it back to the colonial workers and others who are saying there is so much to litigate here. If you open that Pandora's box, the Attorney General opinions, I think, recognize that. And that's part of the reason this interpretation is appropriate. So just to talk briefly about Alfred and Mellon.
As you go into Alfred, you know, I guess the crux of what we have today is this issue as to what benefit is. It's mentioned in passing in Alfred. The district court judge seemed to both feed in that section to make his ruling. Is that really a test? What is this? And why don't you talk about that, because that's germane to what's before us today.
It's not really a test, Your Honor. That would be my initial response. I think it's a good question. That term is used once in the decisions of this court. It wasn't used in Baldonado, incidentally. It was used just in passing. I don't think that there was an intent to establish a direct benefit test in that decision. But in any event, let me explain what direct benefit cannot be. But it cannot be an impermissible direct benefit if you were to meet that test, which I don't think you should. It can't be an impermissible direct benefit if, as a result of tips received, an employer is able to pay less in wages. Because that's how tipping always works. If that is a direct benefit, then tipping is always an improper taking. It just makes no sense. And I'm not just talking about tip pooling. I'm saying any tip practice. Moreover, I often talk about something else that I think sheds light on this. It talked about improved employee retention and morale that had resulted from the tip policy. Now, there are a number of different ways to bring satisfaction to employees in the workplace. But I think we can be confident that the particular way in which employees were motivated to remain and made happier and offered is through the receipt of tips. The other way in which that could have happened, of course, was through a wage increase by the employer. It wasn't particularly important to those employees, presumably, whether they received their money through tips or wages. In other words, an offer the employer was enjoying the same benefit that the plaintiffs now are saying is utterly impermissible. So I think that direct benefit could not mean what plaintiffs are now suggesting it means, nor do I think this court should make it a test. I think what it means is simply another reference to taking, which is what the statute prohibits, and I've explained what that means. The other thing that I think is notable about the Moran case,
the uncertainty surrounding the statute or apparent uncertainty is what causes the judiciary to start dabbling in these tests, which themselves create further uncertainty.
Yes, I very much agree, and I think that if that were made the test, it would become difficult, but especially difficult as the plaintiffs want to try to interpret and apply such a test. The other thing that I think is notable about Alford is how it treated Mullen. Mullen was District Court Judge Thompson's decision. There was no particular deference due to the District Court, and Alford was very explicit about that. Said, hey, it's just a federal court decision. We get to interpret our own statutes. But the court said, based on its interpretation of legislative history, its explanation of historical practice, we accept the interpretation of Mullen. And so Mullen is a very detailed discussion of what practice had been. It talks specifically about sharing tips with supervisors and box persons, which the plaintiffs claim is what's happening here. We don't think CSTLs are floor supervisors. But and so the author did not merely cite Mullen in passing. It engaged with Mullen. Mullen itself engaged very closely with the statute, the history, and the practice, and said it would be wrong to interpret this provision the way the plaintiffs were proposing. So Mullen, I think, is more powerful precedent in this particular case because of the way Alford decided to treat it. And I mentioned, by the way, that the plaintiffs in Mullen were concerned that there was tip sharing with people who weren't dealers. Remember that in this case, page 3 of the Labor Commissioner's decision, the dealers themselves were sharing from the tip pool with the cashier. So this wasn't just a dealer-only tip pool. Again, the example of restaurants is powerful. Waitresses share with busboys. They share with bartenders who are serving drinks brought to the table, whom a customer may never see. But it's recognized that those are people that are contributing to the experience in one way or another as a whole, in the property in the tip pool. So to try to devise a test that focuses on the particular recipient, which this court's decision in Baldonado said is incorrect, or even particular people who interact with the customer, again, becomes an unadministerable test.
Are those sharing arrangements employee-driven or employer-driven?
They can be both. There are certainly, and the industry association brief is very concerned about this, there are certain employer-driven restaurant tip-sharing arrangements that would be, many of them throughout the state, that would be imperiled by the ruling the plaintiffs are seeking here.
The underpinnings of Mullen and Alford are that the employer in an at-will employment relationship can establish the terms of employment, a concept that isn't addressed at all in the statute. But yet, under that concept, seems to drive the allocation or the participants in the sharing group. Is that appropriate?
I think, again, that Alford itself recognizes that there's, and Alvarado as well, that employees can make a decision whether to accept the terms of employment being offered by the employer. And if their decision is to leave and not accept them, that's a choice. If their decision is just to remain as well, then that reflects their agreement. And that's how so many different terms and conditions of employment end up getting effectively negotiated. If I could talk briefly about the Labor Commissioner's decision, because I've talked about the court's decisions. I've touched briefly on the Attorney General opinions. The Barney opinion, by the way, also says you have tip pools at that time that included Florida supervisors and box people. But there's a separate reason that the district court was pulling the rules, which was that it showed no deference whatsoever to the interpretation proffered by the Labor Commissioner. There are several reasons deference was appropriate here, beginning with this court's decision in Baldonado Lynn, where it said the Labor Commissioner has special expertise, and it said that would be optimized, if the case went back to the Labor Commissioner, and there would be findings of law in fact there. That commands deference when it gets to the district court, both under the state's statutes, but also it makes no sense just for this court to have sent it back for expertise being optimized, but then no deference whatsoever. Secondly, I call the court's attention to the international game technology case, which involved a tax question brought initially to this court, and the court said, we think a detailed administrative issue like that is one where we ought to defer to the administrative interpretation of the agency, in that case, the Department of Taxation. I think what happened in Baltimore 1, similar, defer to the agency. There were numerous factual findings as well, which the plaintiffs themselves concede weren't deference, supported by substantial evidence as they plainly are, and the plaintiffs concede that legal interpretations related to those fact findings command deference as well. So just to enumerate some of those, the Labor Commissioner found that the tips weren't necessarily intended for those on whom they were bestowed, that there was a genuine employer service-related interest in having this practice. The Labor Commissioner, of course, found there was no inappropriate taking. All of these fact findings were closely tied to legal conclusions, which together as a constellation weren't deference. It was error not to give them. Finally, this is a criminal statute, although the context here is civil. The meaning it has to be consistent across civil and criminal. It can't be a case that in a civil case such as this, you'd say the practice is impermissible and ordain a particular rule of law and then leave uncertainty what's in the criminal context. For reasons of clarity and efficiency, it should be no interpretation across context. Finally, with regard to the interpretation, I want to talk about the alternatives. I've talked about how hard this test would be to administer. You know that in part because the plaintiffs can't administer their own test. They can't even describe it. So we talked about this in our reply brief, but they suggested a whole variety of ways to administer this. They suggested it should depend on who the tip is bestowed. Baltimore Lynn says that's not true. The fact findings say as well. They suggest that it should be a question of who's tipped or who's nominally tipped. Where do you draw that line? They suggest it should be limited to people in the same classification. That throws out all the restaurant tips, as well as tips that are used in some places elsewhere in the gaming industry. They said if you have similar or maybe identical jobs, well, which is it, and how do you determine that, and again, how do you account for the busboys and the bartender? And then they themselves, on page 17 of their brief, said that there is an impermissible indirect benefit to the women. Twice, on page 17 of their brief, they say that the women is benefiting indirectly. Well, you can see that, but that's entirely permissible, and that is an immense concession on their part. If I can conclude on the class action point, I think what's most notable about that is that it's emblematic of the broader failure to defer to the Labor Commissioner by the court. The Labor Commissioner construed its own regulation of authority and said, I can't do this, and said it's not administrable. In fact, page 3 of his brief, he expresses concern about due process if he were required to conduct class hearings in the way recommended.
Mr. Scott, I was concerned about the class action issue. I know we had a lot of jurisprudence recently developed in the residential construction defect litigation regarding class actions, numerosity requirements, commonality, and things like that. And I, in preparing for the this case, I was concerned how would a non-lawyer go through this and analyze maybe some pretty difficult legal concepts, something like that. And I'd be interested in Mr. Greenberg thinks about that as well. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think it would be a practical impossibility, and I think it would be unconstitutional, because as you know from those cases, there are fundamental constitutional requirements regarding notice, the ability to opt out, and like none of those protections exist here.
But can you sustain your position on the labor statute? We don't need to reach the class action issue, though.
No, Your Honor. Yeah. If no further questions, I will now reserve the remaining for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm William Greenberg, arguing for the respondents. May it please the court. I'd like to begin by answering the last question that was asked regarding the class action issue. What I would advise the court is that the circumstances of this case would allow a class action for two reasons to be proper and to violate no constitutional due process requirements. The first is that this statute, it's in 607, Chapter 607, specifically grants the labor the authority to conduct a trial de novo of whatever is done in the administrative hearing. Therefore, the district court may have to conduct the class action and essentially start from the beginning and go through the process of providing notice and so forth, as is the requirement in the 23B3 class action. However, the circumstances of this case also really are those of the 23B1 or 2 class, where no notice is required because the circumstances of all of the interested persons of the class are identical. All of the members of the putative class here are affected by the same policy. It is an issue of law that this court will resolve in this appeal. When it is resolved, everyone is going to be bound by it. It's not going to matter whether they excluded themselves pursuant to notice that was given to them, because it's precedent. It's the highest court in the state, and everybody's going to be bound by that decision. Further, there are no individual damages that need to be determined for the members of the class, because if we had a situation where some people didn't join the class and others did, well, it's a tick rule. The only way you can figure out what the people who are part of the class are owed is by looking at everybody who is in that pool. So the calculation that will have to be done is going to be identical for as
well. I understand. My concern is this. The Labor Commissioner, I don't know if he's an attorney or not an attorney. I assume he's not. But assuming he's not an attorney, you have to go through class certification. You go through an analysis. You go through complex motions and all like that. And, I mean, they're tough jobs for district court judges that have experience in that area. I mean, how would it be practical for an administrative agency to do that? I realize you say they're relatively simple issues and all, but that does concern me.
Yeah. Well, in the context of this case, I think it clearly is very practical. And the broader issue that you're addressing, we do have the district court that is empowered to conduct the trial de novo and review everything that the Labor Commissioner may choose to do. The problem, Your Honor, is that without a class remedy here, the enforcement of the statute becomes extremely weak. You were mentioning this court's jurisprudence in the class action area, for instance, the Schutz versus Beezer Homes case. And in that case, actually, Your Honor, this court looked to the Ingram decision versus Coca-Cola. Ingram was actually an employment case. And in Ingram, the court noted that the class action device was very important in the employment context because most employees aren't going to come forward to bring claims against their employer. And the same is true here, Your Honor. And so to enforce the statute in this circumstance where the Labor Commissioner has refused to take action, he could take action, but he hasn't. And this court in Baldonado once said he's going to have to hear and determine these claims. We need a remedy that, in fact, will enforce the statute. Now, appellant's counsel has painted really a parade of horrors here that if the district court's decision is upheld, that there's going to be an unenforceable standard, and that respondents have advocated to this court in their submissions to the district court an impossible, elastic standard that has no clear definitions. This is untrue. The standard is very simple. The customer is giving a tip for a service. He's not giving it to the business owner. He's not giving it to the entire operation, the valet.
I mean, yes. I don't see any abuse where you're asking this court to revisit the cases, the decisions of Rome and Herald's Club, are you?
Well, Your Honor, we have no issue.
Your briefs asked us to revisit the underpinnings of those decisions.
Yes, Your Honor. Amoah is discussed at page 19 of the plaintiff's brief. Excuse me, the respondent's brief.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with Moen, Your Honor, is that Moen rewrote the statute. In its discussion of the statute, it first recites the literal language of the statute. And the literal language of the statute says, nothing contained in this section shall be construed to prevent such employees from entering into an agreement to divide such tips or gratuities among themselves. And then after reciting that, it states, an equally reasonable interpretation of the statute, which we think is the proper one in the light of well-known employment practices, is as follows. Nothing contained in this section shall be construed to prevent such employees from entering into an agreement with the employer or the other employees to divide such tips or gratuities among the employees. So, with the wave of the hand, the statutory language gets changed. It's no longer an agreement of such employees to divide such tips among themselves, but with other employees or the employer, and among the employees without limitation. Now, Moen gives us no explanation of why it is changing this language, except that it says, well, this is well-known employment practices. We don't know what they are, because Moen never tells us. And the fact of the matter is that the statute's language, when it speaks of such employees, is talking about a limited group of employees. Otherwise, it would just say employees. There's no reason for the use of the limited term such employees. And as this court is aware, in the Haney case, the advanced spirits decision, when we're construing the statute, we must look at all of the language in the statute, cannot render any words or phrases nugatory, can't read out these words from the statute and act as if they're not there. But that is what Moen did, and that's what appellant is asking this court to do. That's what the Labor Commissioner did. There is a limitation in this statute, and the limitation of such employees is referring back to the protection in the first part of the statute, which says an employer shall not take any tips or gratuities that are bestowed upon their employees. So the such employees are the ones who are given the tips. Now, why does the customer give the tip? The customer is given the tip.
I want to follow up on that, because it concerns me that we have Moen, and it appears to me from the order or opinion that Judge Thompson was saying there's two ways to read this paragraph 2. One, you can read it to say the agreement must be among the employees and among themselves refers to the making of the agreement. Or two, you can read it as the sharing being among the employees, but the agreement can be among the employees and the employer or just among the employees themselves. I don't really throw in with you on that being a wholesale revision of the statute, but let's accept for sake of argument it is. Time passes, and this court hands down Alford. Alford expressly states, we don't have to follow federal court, but we're going to. And it does. Now, admittedly, Alford doesn't test the bounds of other categories of employees, but nonetheless, that's the Alford analysis. We also have an AGO, which throws in with Judge Thompson's interpretation of the statute in Moen. And to my mind, if there's a problem with those readings of that statute, it was for the legislature to create them. We have a long history of acquiescence in Nevada on those statutory interpretations. And it bothers me from a stare decisis standpoint and an induced reliance standpoint that those have stood so long. And now you're bringing it as if we are looking at this for the first time. And that's my concern with your argument. So if you could address that point, I don't know if it's a follow-along to Justice Hardesty's exactly or not, but before you leave answering his question, I'd like to understand your answer to that.
Well, to answer your question, Justice Pickering, first of all, Attorney General Bryan's opinion was written after Moen, but before Alford. Prior to Alford, it was unknown, in fact, whether tip pools could be compelled at all by employers in the state of Nevada. Now, the protection of the statute would be extremely easy to enforce if tip pools could never be compelled by the employer, because the employees, just if they didn't like the tip pool, they thought the tip pool was resulting in them losing out, they just wouldn't use it. But Alfred embraced Mullen only to the extent, as we were discussing earlier on Appellant's argument, that it is appropriate to allow the employer to direct the tip pool be imposed because of the at-will circumstances and so forth. And in this case, there's no dispute of that branch of Alfred. People could dispute it, but it's not disputed. However, when Alfred looked at Mullen, it was only adopting Mullen as to that issue. And the authority of Alfred says, and I quote, "We hold that the district court correctly concluded," the district court knew Mullen, "that NRS 608.160 does not prohibit an employer from requiring employees to enter into a tip pool arrangement such as that imposed in the instant case." Now, why was that limiting language put in there? It was put in there because they were not addressing the issue, the broader issue of who could participate in the tip pool and Alfred. And in fact, I would submit that to the extent that they were concerned about that issue, they were very explicit in saying that that would not be proper by fashioning this direct benefit test.
So your point then is that you have no quarrel with Alfred.
That is correct. Mullen was wrongly decided. It was a question, quite honestly, of the court in that case substituting its view of what the policy should be rather than for what the legislature had commanded the court to actually do.
And you're saying that Alfred doesn't buy into that piece of Mullen. It only buys into the idea that an employer can require a tip pooling arrangement.
Only to the extent that it does not directly benefit the employer. And when Alfred talks about direct benefit, it's talking about the restrictions of the statute preventing an employer from accessing or using the employee's tips for its direct benefit. Now,
then it's being kind to Alfred. The discussion we were about to go off into, the reading, and I'm sitting here rereading it as you're speaking, is so very limited. And that's very troubling in terms of trying to really determine what direct benefit means. The elements asking us, since you're asking us at one point to throw out Mullen for the most part, now you're indirectly asking us to throw out Alfred, but yet still wanting to argue their interpretation of direct benefit. What's your response to that?
I'm not asking the court to deviate from the direct benefit standard that Alfred created. In fact, that's the entirety of what the district court below relied on.
Look, what did they create? Where in the case did they create something except for this little passing reference? And then we almost have to go back to the miscellaneous conversation in Mullen about the not direct benefit, but the incidental benefit it's received, which in almost anything there's an incidental benefit. And the question is, under the statute, the only benefit it really talks about is that the employer can't use the money for its own benefit or use it to subsidize the minimum wage requirement.
Yes, but what is
the second section?
Yes, Your Honor, but what if we have a situation such as here where the dealers are already only paid the minimum wage? We can't reduce the wages any less. The only way he can benefit from this
is not what the statute addresses.
So, Your Honor, the statute would be rendered completely ineffective if an employer is allowed to take the tips from such employees upon whom they were bestowed, which is the limited group of employees referred to in the second section of the statute, and give them to other employees who did not get those tips and who were providing a different service. The rationalization for the tip pool that was allowed in Alfred and that the dealers in this case are perfectly content to participate in is that it's among only the dealers. And again, this goes to the customer bestowing the tip for a service. That is the distinction that this court needs to enforce. And that is the only way that this statute can have any meaningful force if employers are going to be allowed to impose tip pools.
So this is this question that was brought up before, I think Justice Hardesty mentioned it to opposing counsel, as to the sharing and the tip pooling by the cashiers. Is that
Your Honor, that's really a misstatement of the facts. The tip claim agreement required that something like $50 a shift was taken from the dealers to some given to the cashier for the cost of counting the tips. There was no sharing with the cashier of the tips, per se. And again, the standard that needs to be realized here is a standard that keeps the tips with the employees for whom the customer gave the tip. Now, there's discussion by counsel for appellant about how well the labor commissioner, why does the customer tip? And it's not a question of why, it's a question of who, what for. The customer is giving the tip for a particular service. Prior to this tip pool being instituted, the room prohibited the floor supervisors from accepting tips. It then gave them a share of the dealer's tips. It was not content to simply lift its ban on the floor supervisors receiving tips and let those employees share among themselves such tips that they were bestowed by the customers for providing the services that they provide. It is a distinction not based upon job title or some other impossible determination, but upon what service is being provided. The dealers are dealing with the scenario game. They get tipped for that. If the player gets a drink from the cocktail waitress at the table, he tips the cocktail waitress. If the floor supervisor comes over and helps him with his marker, gets him his tickets for his show or his restaurant reservation, let him give a tip to the floor supervisor. They're providing different services. Now, the reason why the room is not content to respect that division is because it knows the floor supervisors are not going to receive any significant amount of tips. So it wants to take the tips that were given to the floor supervisors by the customers for the services they provided to those customers and give them to the floor supervisors, who the customers haven't found worthy of receiving that tip.
Well, that may be true, but it seems that the reason I asked you whether you'd ask this court to revisit the underpinnings of Alford is because Alford seems to say that even based on the construction in Mullen, that employers can impose a tip pool agreement among employees, and that would seem to suggest even groups of employees, and this court then said that that interpretation is the correct one. You don't seem to ask this court to revisit Alford and reject the notion that an employer can establish a tip pooling agreement. In fact, you seem to suggest exactly the opposite.
We are not asking this court to revoke the portion of Alford that allows the employer to impose the tip pooling agreement, but this goes to the question which I believe you asked earlier of appellant's counsel, is that, well, if we allow the employer to require it, do we also allow the employer to dictate the terms or to control the terms? I submit the terms are controlled by the statutory language. We cannot ignore the use of these limiting terms in the statute. Who are these such employees that are referred to in the second part of the statute? They can only be the employees upon whom the tips were bestowed in the first part of the statute. The only way to reach the result that is urged by appellant in this case is to ignore the actual language of the statute, to do the same thing that was done in Moran. That clearly would be an improper use of this court's authority. Now, in respect to the language in Alfred, as Your Honor was stating, it was an extremely brief decision. And in the decision, if you actually read the two sentences that it is quoting from Moran and that it agrees with, it's the sentences that read, the evident purpose and proper interpretation of the statute is that it was enacted to prevent the taking of tips by an employer for the benefit of the employer. And that is exactly what is going on here. The employer is taking the dealer's tips for its benefit, not for the benefit of the dealer's
collection. Let's address that issue. The factual determinations by the Labor Commissioner indicate that the room is not taking these tips. It seems to me that there's substantial evidence in the record to support that determination. Why should this court reject deference on that factual determination?
Respectfully, Your Honor, that factual determination Commission has simply stated as a conclusion. It actually cites nothing in the record. The respondents actually
enjoyed the stipulation that counsel referred to certainly seems to suggest that.
Well, Your Honor, with all due respect,
you characterize it in your briefs as an indirect benefit.
Your Honor, the statement is that what Lynn is doing is indirectly taking tips. It's not an indirect benefit. It is an indirect process. Rather than take a certain portion of the dealer's tips, give it to Treasury, and then go and give its floor supervisors a raise commensurate with that amount that they put in its Treasury, they say, oh no, we're not really taking the tips. We're just moving them over here to the floor supervisors. It's simply an accounting
law. All of this is that if Alfred authorizes an employer of this state to establish a tip pool agreement, then what you're suggesting is that in every instance, that constitutes a taking of the tips because the tip pool agreement itself dictates some term, some people are left in and some people are excluded. And that, you're saying, constitutes a taking by the employer. Is that what your argument is?
No, Your Honor. What I am trying to communicate to the court is what was done in Alfred when it approved of the tip pool in this case. The tips must remain with the employees who are rendering the service for which the customer gave them. The dealer's tips remain with the dealers. Yes, some will get more, some will get less under the tip pool situation. And there is an indirect benefit to the employer from that, which was recognized at Alfred, which is that the dealers are all happier because their earnings are equalized. They're not going to be feeling bad because somebody got a good shift and somebody got a bad shift in terms of tips and so forth and so on. And that's fine, and that complies with the purpose of the statute. Allowing the employer to take the tips from the dealers and give them to the floor supervisors in this case simply increases the profits of the casino. This is well demonstrated in the record in respect to the operations at the Riverside Law Firm Casino. The Riverside Law Firm testified before the Labor Commissioner, and it is the only other casino in the state of Nevada that has such a policy. They pay their floor supervisors a compensation package which is competitive with the law firm marketplace, but they only have to pay from their own funds about one half of that amount of compensation. The other half they get by taking it from the dealer's tip pool. And the dealers, of course, collectively pay for that. They lose it out. And that money is just a pure profit to the Riverside Law Firm. It's that simple. And the reason why Alfred speaks of a direct benefit is because money is fungible for this statute to have any life, to have any force, to have any protective power to protect the tip workers in Nevada. This court must impose a limit upon who can participate in these tip pools. This is
the Labor Commissioner characterized that as a collateral benefit, specifically in being able to recruit employees, better employees, and manage turnover.
Well, Your Honor, it characterized that, and those benefits were experienced among the floor supervisors. And they experienced them among the floor supervisors because they were getting a lot more money now. They didn't want to become dealers. Prior to this policy being instituted, the rule was essentially underpaying the floor supervisors. They got $60,000 a year. The dealers were getting $20,000 or $30,000 a year more than them because they only got minimum wage, but they got tips because the customers rewarded them. Well, the purpose of the statute is to recognize the choice of that customer. The customer isn't giving that money to the main casino just as additional voluntary revenue that the business should enjoy and dispose of however it feels like.
It's not at all what's happening here. And I think the statute, I think we're long past where we're advocating we should go, both statutory and with our current case law. I've been listening to your analysis, and I can't figure out one situation where the statutorily recognized tip pool process would ever satisfy the criteria that we're looking for. Because you can turn everything into some benefit or some revenue going back to, as in this case, the win. I'm troubled.
Well, what the court needs to, again, recognize is the fundamental nature of money. When the employer takes the tips that were given for for one service by the customer. In this case, the tips are given to the dealers for providing a service and dealing with the casino game. I think that's pretty clear. The employer can benefit however it wants from those tips as long as they stay with the dealers who provided that service. That is the rule that this court must impose. It is a very simple rule. Once the employer starts taking those tips from the dealers who provided that service that the customer gave them to, it just becomes another source of revenue to the business that they can take.
That's the kind of logic I'm just not
following. Yes.
If that's true, then why would the culinary come in favor of Wynn's tip pooling policy? Why would he come? And they're also saying, not necessarily that the apparel is saying about the horrors, but our culinary union is saying, don't mess with this. We like the way it is right now with tip pooling. So explain that. I mean, how do we ignore the culinary union?
The culinary union, in the first page of the brief, acknowledges they actually have no dog in this fight, because they're governed by federal labor laws. Their collective bargaining agreements can supersede any decision this court makes in respect to what state law requires, because federal law is supreme. So their collective bargaining agreements can create whatever innovative tip pools they think are important to their members or their industry.
But if dealers are members of a union, they too can engage in collective bargaining on this issue.
They could.
Interfering with collective bargaining if the dealers happen to be union members?
No, absolutely not. What the court would be doing is creating simply a legal standard that the employee enjoys, which it's not this court actually creating that standard. It's the legislature who's enacted the law. The legislature has enacted a public policy in this state regarding this issue, and so the court is enjoying the benefit of this legal standard. It's no different than the minimum wage that Nevada requires employers to pay. And by the way, the culinary union is a very strong advocate of raising the minimum wage in Nevada, which makes no sense given the position in this case that these sort of labor standard regulations are improper and strongly left to the free market and to employers and employees. The culinary union has entered this case simply as an agent of the Wynn casino and of the resort industry with which it has collective bargaining agreements.
If we follow your logic, we start back with where the report started, and that is a straight-up interpretation of the statute. So, other than this revenue stream that you keep talking about that goes back to the room, that I'm admittedly having a hard time seeing, how does what is happening, simple question, how does what is happening here violate the terms and conditions that are set forth in the statute? Because clearly, you're not asking us to rewrite the statute, we couldn't do that anyhow.
It's the direct benefit. This was the decision, this is the principle that the district court rested on. The direct benefit to the Wynn in this case is that it gives raises of $30,000 a year to its floor supervisors from tips that they didn't get, tips that were given by the customers.
So went into the pool?
Well, it went to the dealers because the dealers provided the service for them.
It went into the pool?
Well, Your Honor, to the extent that the floor supervisors are contributing to that pool, it is not a contribution that is worthy of recognition, because if it was, and they were only drawing in any remote way fairly from that pool, we wouldn't be here. The Wynn would be compelled to sharing between the dealers and the floor supervisors, except for the fact that the floor supervisors aren't getting anything more than a nominal amount of tips, Your Honor. The Wynn also actually...
If you were to define direct benefit, offer us how you would define the correct analysis under this statute to separate the facts in Alford from the facts before us today. In defined terms, what test would you say would mark or distinguish or describe a direct benefit and a permissible employer-imposed tip pool versus an impermissible one?
A permissible employer tip pool would require employees who provide the same service to share the tips among themselves who provide that service. The tips given for that service stay with the employees who provided that service. Now,
so it would be, what about weekend dealers versus graveyard Tuesday night dealers?
If the employer wished to limit the tip pool in that fashion, in some instances you have casinos which perhaps do 24-hour splits, weekly splits, shift splits, we're not taking an issue with that because, again, the tips, the economic benefit, is remaining with the people who provided the service for which the customer gave the tip. appellate likes to confuse the situation here with the restaurant industry, where we have individuals such as the busboy and the waiter, and perhaps a bar person who fixes the drink that the waiter then brings to the customer, because they split tips. This isn't a restaurant industry situation, but even in that situation, those people are not providing the same service.
So you would define it in terms of service?
In terms of whatever the service is being provided to the customer. In this case, it's very clear that the dealers and the floor supervisors do not provide the same services. My time is over, but it's almost up. I just want to note to the court that if the court rejects the district court's ruling, which was based solely on its analysis of the direct benefit limitation, it needs to remand this case back to the district court so the district court can properly analyze what the statute requires, because appellant's position is that the statute only prohibits direct participation in the tip pool by people who are employers. The Labor Commission required a clearly erroneous standard by using NAC, I don't have the reference, instead of 608.011 to evaluate that issue. And also the district court never reached the issue of whether 613.120 or 608.100 prohibit the activities that are issued in this case, because it rested on its direct benefit analysis at its interpretation of Alford, essentially its application of that to the statute. Thank you.
Mr. Scalia.
Just a few points. Justice Hardiston, in response to a point you raised, also on page 37 of their brief, the dealers conceded that they were not challenging the Alford rule and they were content with it. It's not in the picture, and it should not be. With respect to direct benefit, Justice Otis, as you noted, it's not a test in Baldonado. It's a phrase. In Alford, it never appears again in this court's cases. It should not be enshrined as a test now. Moreover, we have not heard a clear articulation of what such a test would be. The direct beneficiaries, as essentially Mr. Greenberg told you, are the CSTLs who receive the money. That is the direct benefit, is the actual receipt of that money that's coming from the pool. And those CSTLs do contribute to the service, as the Labor Commissioner found. So also, obviously, does the box person at the craps table, which the plaintiffs have repeatedly sought to avoid. All of these people contribute to the service. It would be impossible to attempt to disentangle the different ways in which they contribute to the customer's enjoyment of their visit and experience at the Wynn Casino. Now, Mr. Greenberg suggested some different approaches. He said it's a question of who got the tip. Again, he's in the teeth of the Baldonado decision. Footnote 12 says it's not the employee's money. The tip is not necessarily for the person on whom it's bestowed, and that's what the Labor Commissioner found in the finding of fact. So he's in the teeth of that as well. Another test that we were told was simply what service was provided, but that can't be mapped over to the restaurant industry in any way. It does not reflect how industrial practice has been conducted, and it cannot explain the fact that the dealers were already sharing $50 with the cashier. May not be a large amount of money, but indisputably the cashiers were beneficiaries of that tip pool and were not contributing to the service at all. Final points. Chief Justice Pickering talked about how long Alford's been in the books. It has, in fact, stood the test of time, producing extraordinarily little litigation. Mr. Greenberg has been utterly unable to respond to all the different problems that would occur in litigation if this court were to step into this space, which was intended to be a safe harbor, and try to apply judicially administrable standards. It would be unworkable and immensely time-consuming and very disruptive to industry. Deference. The statutory language here is clear. There are precedents of this court which make it clear, but if that's not enough, we have as well the deference due the special expertise of the Labor Commission and the factual findings that he made to resolve this case. Finally, with respect to the other claims that are advanced by plaintiff, those are entirely non-meritorious. This court should reverse the decision with instructions that the other claims be dismissed, because those are simply different attempts to use other statutory provisions to attack a practice that is explicitly licensed and protected by the safe harbor provision of the Nevada tip provision. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Thank you very much. This case will stand submitted, and will be at ease. while the courtroom clears and the next lawyers come forward.